Now I would like to introduce tonight's speaker, Carl.
Thank you. Can you hear me back there? Okay, clear. Okay, good. Damn. I just buzzed. I better take this. I'll just be a second. Just hold on. Yeah, this is Carl. Yeah, I'm on the chairman of the entertainment committee. Yeah, for the talent show for the AA Al-Anon Roundup. Yeah, we have another spot. You can 5-7 minutes, whatever, you know. But you have to audition. What do you want to do? Oh, I'm sorry. I really don't think that a striptease would be in order. No, it doesn't really matter that you've gone out and bought yourself a new pair of tassels. Yeah, well, don't all tassels sparkle? I mean, what's so special about that? Oh, you mean sparks? Real sparks? Well, that would be dangerous. I mean, you don't have on, you know, much to speak of, and you could burn yourself. The sparks never touch you. How is that? Oh, I get, yeah, centrifugal force. It's so that, yeah, it's like one of those things, the 4th of July, you know, it goes zzzz and the sparks all go out, you know. A Catherine wheel. All right, in your case, two Catherine wheels. In opposite directions? At the same time? Oh, yeah, and, well, I realize one at a time would look kind of silly, but... Look, I got to tell you... No, I'm sure you make the sparks really fly, but that's not the point. Really, that far? That's incredible. You must have... what are you saying, Jack? This is not stand-up night? It's what, it's Al-Anon night? Oh, man. Oh, my goof. I'm sorry, everybody. But I'm going on 84, and I get my... And anyway, the germ for that idea, I started with our friend Gordon. And the last time I saw him, I left him laughing, falling off his sofa. And that's how I want to remember him. But I don't know what happens afterwards, but I hope you could have heard that. And you too, Jim, Aaron, Sleeveless Steve, Scotty, all beautiful men that were in our program. So as you can tell, I'm getting serious now. I'm going to go on about... My name is Carl, by the way.
By the way.
And... It's a serious matter, alcoholism and Al-Anonism, so therefore, no more jokes. Finished. That's it. Over. Done with. We're going to be serious around this place. You know, before program, this is an analogy, and, you know, analogies are not perfect, but you'll get the picture. Before program, I was very much like the family dog. Now, the dog is a well-loved member of the family. Everybody loves the dog loves everybody else. The dog will do anything to please you. You know, he'll let you know when people are coming, friends, strangers, whatever. If the house is on fire, he'll let you know before the smoke alarm. He'll do stupid dog tricks for you at parties. You want him to fetch, he'll fetch. You want him to pull a sled, he'll pull a sled. If you got a problem with your eyes, he'll be your eyes, he'll be your nose, he'll be your ears. He'll point at things for you to hunt. You get lost out in the Swiss Alps, he'll show up with a little mini keg of brandy so you can get a slug and enable yourself to get up and go back to the chalet for another snort. And all in all, the dog will do anything to please anybody. That's his job in life. and he needs a little care. And, you know, so, and he's patient, you know, he has to be taken out for a run once in a while, but as dogs, we're very patient. You're not ready yet? Okay, I'll wait. All right, I'll wait. Okay, you're not ready? It's okay, don't worry about it. Oh, finally you're ready, you're going to take me out now. Oh, thank you so much. Oh, thank you. Well, that was all before program, and now nearly 28 years later, I'm much more like the family cat. Now, as a cat, I'm a much loved member of the family, and I love everybody else too. And I love you, and you love me, and we know that because we share our lives together. But guess what? Your life is not my life. I have a life. Now, you want to get me to do a lot of different things, but I won't necessarily do all of them. I mean, I may stop shredding the furniture, but, you know, you're not so perfect yourself. I walk into the living room and you're sitting in my seat. What the hell's that all about? And unlike the dog, you know, I don't bark at you about it. And I certainly don't lift my leg and pee on you about it. You know, I give you a filthy look and I go sit elsewhere. But I'll do work. You know, you got mice, rats, I'll take care of that. And if the house is on fire, believe me, I'll let you know about that too. I believe in self-preservation. But the one thing I'm really good at, better than anybody else, is I'm the world's best listener. You got a problem, I'll see it. I can't solve your problem, but I can help you solve it. Because I'll climb into your lap, and I'll put my arms around you. I'll open my eyes wide and look up into yours, and you'll know how much I love you, and you'll feel me purring. And you'll know that even though it's a big problem, but everything will be all right. And you'll stroke my fur, and your heart rate will go down, your blood pressure will go down. And you'll get to know that's going to be okay. Just don't wake me from a nap to tell me your troubles. Wait. And don't forget, in the afternoons, I'm out the door about 3:30 doing my rounds, and I'm expected. There's that neighbor's dog three houses down. I give him obedience lessons every day at 3:30. He's expecting me. And maybe by the time I get back, your problem will have solved itself and gone away. You don't need me after all. That's okay, too. But if it hasn't, I'll climb into your lap. I'll listen to your troubles, and I'll make you feel better. I'll let you know how much I love you. That's the end of the analogy. Meow. The way I came to be a dog, well, let's put it this way, put it real simple. It was all my mother's fault. She was actually a very good woman, and my dad was a good father. They didn't have it quite right when they first had me. But that wasn't their fault. They got it better later on. By the time my kid brother was born, he was brought up quite differently. I was well-loved and well-taken care of. But also, that love could be removed at a moment's notice with a slap across the face or clothes ripped off and a leather belt came out. And that was at early ages. I mean, I remember getting hit when I was 4. I got the leather belt beating when I was 6. The neighbors were going to call the cops. This is back in 1937. They were going to call the cops. I obeyed my parents. I did everything they said. I wanted to please them no end. My mother wanted perfect. She was an untreated Al-Anon. Her father was a drunk. She came from Austria. I never met the man. But her Al-Anonism was right there and passed on to me, along with many gifts, which I'll go on about later. And my dad, interestingly enough, when he was 3, his father died, and he grew up in a household with 3 older sisters and his mother. He was influenced by women from the age of 3 until 12 when his mother remarried, and his attitude toward women was remarkable. He respected them as people and their intelligence and their judgment. And that rubbed off on me, too. That's how I treated women, other girls. They were people, and they had brains. That was unusual back then for a guy to think that way. But I know it wore off on me. My dad was my role model. But I thought of women as equals. I remember in school, I'm talking about 1944, we're taking home repair, and the girls are taking home ec. And I said to one of the guys, the teachers, I said, when are we going to switch? I said, what are you talking about? I said, well, you know, if a guy's living alone, he's going out, he pops a button, it's nice to know how to sew it on fast, or, you know, you got to maybe press something quickly. And what about girls? Why should they have to hire a plumber? Because the toilet is going drip, 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 and it won't quite shut off. It's very easy. I mean, you take off the tank top, there's a float valve there, you know, and it's also called a ball cock. And I said, you can teach a girl everything she needs to know in 5 minutes about ball cocks. So the guy wanted to give me detention, you know. And I finally talked him out of it, and then he offered me a spot at the local Elf Club the following Saturday night. And that's when I started my career. Not really. But I respected women in that respect, which is not to say that I didn't, you know, not attracted to women in other ways, too. I think I was about 6 and a half when I tried to enter the field of gynecology. My dad discouraged me from that, suggested I put it on hold for a few years. And I did for a few years, yes, indeed. But there I was, this kind of obey everybody, follow all the rules. I did it in school. I do what my teachers told me. And that was good. I happened to be smart, which is great. That was a gift from the university. I take no credit for that any more than I take credit for being heterosexual. Don't blame me for being straight. But I was, in fact, easy to get along with. It was all overdone. I was too obedient, too polite. But that was my problem. It didn't matter on the outside. I found life very easy getting along with other people. I never had fights. But I needed to please everybody else. It was very important what other people thought of me, because I couldn't generate that for myself. And that's important for me to tell in my story, because later on, I got that from my wife. But it was so bad that for me that when we moved into a new neighborhood, and I was about 10 years old at the time, and in order to join the gang, they wanted me to break one of the commandments. And I'd been a Catholic for about 2 years, and boy, they had me by the throat. I got to tell you, I found out that the ruler was not just for measuring or drawing straight lines. It was called a knuckle whacker. And they really disciplined with slaps and hits and all that stuff. And they scared you. And I knew that if I was going to commit a sin and I didn't get to confession, and I died before then, I'd be in hell forever. And what these kids wanted me to do was to boost a comic book out of the local drugstore. And I sweated and sweated. And I finally thought, it was so important to be accepted by these people. I went ahead and I shoplifted the comic book. And they went, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I went to bed that Saturday night and I couldn't sleep. I knew that I have to get the confession before the following Saturday. If I got run over by a bus, I'd be in hell forever. And I didn't sleep. I knew something terrible was going to happen because I'd stolen this comic book. And sure enough, it did. The next day it was Pearl Harbor. I thought I was to blame. I took the comic book back on Monday. And I told the owner what happened. And he was so impressed, he gave me a job Friday afternoons and all day Saturday, running errands and sweeping and doing various things like that. And I never regretted the decision to take the comic book back. Except a couple of weeks ago when I saw that on eBay, I could have sold that issue for $14,000. Anyway, this is the guy who sallies forth into the world. And as even when I went into the Army, I was with the recruiting sergeant, my father was there. He told me later on that the sergeant said I would make a perfect soldier. He was not to worry about me. I got a good conduct medal going into the Army. I did get one coming out, but, you know, that's how I was. And then I'm marching along, pursuing my career. I switched. I started life as an engineer. And then for whatever reasons, I got into this other racket. And I was studying in New York. And one day, I happened to see a movie, and I saw this actress I'd never seen before, never heard of, and it turned out to be her first movie, and she never did very many of them, but she was so good. And I went, wow, and I really admired that talent. And lo and behold, 6 months later, I got my first job, which is on Broadway, and it was understudying the leading man and playing a small part. So I go into rehearsal, and who walks in? This woman whose talent, you know, I just fell in love with. And instead of having a Southern accent, which she had in the movie, she had a slight English accent, slightly husky voice. Very sexy. I mean, really cool. And the package was great. I mean, she was wearing a T-shirt and blue jeans, and she was the chicest thing I'd ever seen. I couldn't believe it. I fell in love with the outsides as well. And then I found out who she was. And she was somebody. And I thought, well, that's it. I mean, they were writing parts for her. She'd already won awards. She'd been nominated for Tony. She could have had any man on Broadway that she wanted. I found out there was some guy who had 1/4 of the world's money who was after her. You know, where would I come in? This would be stupid. And besides, we'll never meet. But that wasn't true, because as the understudy to the lead, other actors wanted to run scenes with the leading man, but he was busy doing other scenes. So the next thing you know, I'm running lines with this incredible lady. And we finish up doing a few scenes, and she said, you know, you're very good. Wow, up there. And the next thing you know, I find out she's not a snob. She grew up with wealth and fame, but it didn't matter to her. Her parents had stars on the boulevard. It didn't matter to her. She didn't care about fancy restaurants, big cars, or anything like that, jewels. She was just as happy, as it turns out, on her hands and knees in the Rose Garden pulling weeds as she was on stage trying to win an Emmy. It was all the same to her. This was an incredible human being. So I fell in love with the insides, too. And why she took to me, I can't be sure about everything, but she did say one thing. Oh, she said a few things, but the one thing that was important, she said, you treated me like a person, like no man ever respected me for being a person with a brain. That wasn't me on purpose. That just happened. But it got us together. I mean, I saw the green light, and bingo, we were. It was like two pieces of wreckage on the high seas. Clang! And we just floated that much better. It was terrific. And she became part of me. She took me to parties, and suddenly I'm rubbing elbows with famous people, people that I'd seen on television, people that I'd read about. They're talking to me. Suddenly I'm somebody. I mean, my name's in the gossip columns. I call up my parents one day. I said, you know, the show, I said, all those people were at this party, and I met all of them. They go, wow. So all of this extra stuff, you know, is suddenly filling me with, my God, you know, I felt like I was somebody instead of a nobody. And she was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. The outsides were helping my insides. I didn't know how to work from the inside yet. But I allowed that to carry me. And so we got really tight and intermingled, and she was part of my persona. So much so that, you know, it's almost like a sick joke. I mean, I said to her one day, Sarah, if I were you, and I am, she asked me to get her some aspirin one day, and I got the aspirin. I gave her some aspirin. I took some aspirin. She had the headache. Why did I take the aspirin? I don't know, but you see, that's the kind of relationship it was, and I didn't realize that that is what was happening. So that when the alcoholism kicked in, you know, it was important for me to see that it didn't go any further, and that we wouldn't have any more scenes out in public and all of that sort of thing. So I had to get in there for a lot more reasons than like the average husband might have. Because one, her drinking out in public, if she couldn't handle it, we reflected it on me. And you don't want to be known, because I came out here and she followed me. So, wow, what a compliment. I must be somebody. It must be something good about me for this to happen. We didn't go to too many Hollywood parties. It was just as well. But we came home from one night, and she had been behaving not very well. What I didn't understand was she was in a blackout. So the things she said, she didn't even know she was saying. I lost it. I slapped her. And I thought, God, I've never hit anybody in my life. What is this all about? So I took myself off to a counselor, and in no time, that was over and done with. Because he just pointed out one thing to me, and it made perfect sense. He said, with your wife, you're bigger and stronger than she is, and you know if you lose it and let go and you hit her, you'll get away with it. But if I bring over a guy who's 7'3 and 300 pounds and he pushes all your buttons, you're not going to lose it with him. You're not going to slap him because he can break you in half. He said, yeah, I understand that. He said, so the choice is you want to be continue as a bully? I said, but she was so... That's a bully. What do you want to be, a real man? I said, real man. When do we start? He said, we have. Never looked back. She never had to worry. I never raised a hand to her again. I got the message. I passed that information on to a class of in anger management. And they didn't know where it came from. And I told them it was me. I was their counselor. I had no trouble with those guys. But anyway, we go through 22 years of drinking, and it was interesting. Because she was periodic, and because she didn't get stinking drunk every time. And we moved to England, and we just started to do, after I had a couple of really devastating Hollywood disappointments. So went there just for a year. We stayed for 12. She did a lot of plays. So did I. And she never drank when she worked. She didn't drink for a year. Year and a half at a time. 6 months at a time. Everything was fine. What we had in our marriage was right there, manifest, and we could enjoy it and love it, know what it was all about, and appreciate it. And then the drink would hit. And then it wouldn't be too bad. And then that's how it went. But I had all the benefits of living with an alcoholic. Anything wrong with my life, if only she stopped drinking, everything would be fine. My career went down the tubes. You know, if she wouldn't be drinking, that wouldn't happen. You know, you just lean on them, and you're the scapegoat for everything. We came back to the States, and she had met her Eskimo. We were on a project in Paris for about 3 months, and it was a very famous, wonderful actor who was her Eskimo. And it wasn't but a few months later when we came back from Paris that she took herself off to AA and never had another drink thereafter, and that was 1981. She did a six-year tour of pills, prescription pills, and that was interesting, but because you know, it gives you moods and that sort of thing, but it wasn't as bad as the alcohol. And all through those years when I had made threats, I'm going to leave if you don't do it, that was all past now, because we were never going to separate. I was never going to walk out on her. The connection we had in the first place, aside from the sick psychological stuff, we dug each other. I mean, just period, passionately. And we liked each other. And nothing was ever going to tear us apart. And I'm glad that alcohol did not tear us apart. She got into rehab, and they had to detox her and get rid of everything, and that was happening. And that's when I was in the hospital checking her in, and the nurse said, here, this is for you for 28 days. Your wife's in lockdown. You'll want to attend seminars and couples groups and this and that and the other thing. And sure, I'll do all of that stuff. And she said, and you'll go to Al-Anon. I said, what's that? She said, oh, that's for your disease, honey. So we had this short, spirited conversation, and I got into the elevator, and I got the things there, and as the doors are closing, she said, go to the basement, turn left, there's a meeting in progress, and the door slid shut. I wanted to, she never saw the Sicilian sign, you know, and I don't know, and the elevator started going, so I whacking the buttons and everything, and when the doors open up, I'm in the basement. I said, oh, okay, so I turned left, and I walked into this meeting. And there was one seat in the back, so I had to go through this mass of women to get to the back seat. And as I'm making it a nuisance of myself, I hear out of the corner of my ear, oh, hi, my name is Goody Two Shoes, and I made amends to my alcoholic. You want to hear that at your first Al-Anon meeting, the very first words you hear? I sat down in the back, and I thought, I got to get out of here. But I was too embarrassed to go picking my way through this mass of women, you know. And finally, fortunately, the meeting was almost over. And then the woman said, hi, I'm Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm. Your leader. thank you for letting me lead. And she reads the closing. It goes on, you know how they say it. And for the newcomer, though you may not like all of us, you'll love us in a very special way. The same way we already love you. Ooh, yeah. No, blah. So I tried to get out, and they stopped me. And it was a Hammerlock and a half Nelson. And this, you know, the newcomer's a guy. Don't let him out. And they said the Serenity Prayer, and they shoved stuff into my hands as I tried to escape. And newcomer's pack. And I got out of there, and I got home. And that night, I was sitting there alone, and I had the newcomer pack, and the cat jumped into my lap. And thank you. And I started reading Understanding Ourselves, and bingo, I got the message. And I never looked back. I started going to meetings and everything. And before I knew it, I was doing step one, which is the first part of step one, powerless over alcohol. Essentially, for Al-Anons, it is mind your own business. And I began to mind my own business, and I got out of her face. I accepted the fact that alcoholism is a disease, just as anorexia is a disease. Once I accepted that, I realized, oh my God, I shouldn't have behaved the way I did all those years, and so forth. I would only have known better, but like so many people, you think you understand the word alcoholism. I didn't. It's like you don't understand a lot of things. I mean, when I do little bits on Shakespeare, I tell people, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo? I'm up in the balcony, dear. It is much cheaper here. And that's because they don't know that the word wherefore does not mean where. It means why. Why are you Romeo, the man that I fall in love with? Why do you have to be Romeo from that family that hates my family? You go through a whole life and not know what wherefore means. It's not going to cost you anything. You learn it when you learn it. You learn it tonight. You learn it 30 years ago. It doesn't matter. But it doesn't ruin your life because you didn't know what it meant. But I didn't know what alcoholism was. And if I had understood that much that my wife was an alcoholic and known what it was a disease, we would have saved ourselves so much crap. And so was she. Because she didn't know what was wrong. She was so grateful for what she found out, that she was just a sick person trying to get well. And she embraced it. So I embraced the program and grabbed a hold of a sponsor as soon as I could. And the first thing he said, put this on the mirror. You are looking at the problem, okay? And I did that. And I said, I'm worried about doing the steps. I said, like step four and five. He says, I have a cure for that. Don't worry. Well, I said, what's that? He said, work on step one. You see, I make things complicated. He makes things simple. He's still my sponsor. I hear the slogans, first things first, and stay in the moment and do it now. And then I go, oh, God, sickening. But if I go to the guru on the mountain, who is now my higher power, by the way, and say, what's the secret to happiness? He looks at me and he says, did you have breakfast this morning? I say, yes. He says, then wash your bowl. I go, wow, man, is that deeper? What? It's first things first. Is stay in the moment, do the next indicated step. But that's too simple for my mind. I've got to make it really complicated. My sponsor keeps me grounded. He said one day, he said, I think maybe you're your own worst enemy. And I said, well, no, I don't think so. My first wife is still alive. He said, oh, we're going to have a lot of fun doing the steps. Well, we did. And we went through them, and we just had a good time. He was so patient with me, I can't tell you. And I learned so much, and things began to change inside. And slowly, one of the things that happens with this program is that I began to do what is right because it is right. Not because I was afraid of getting punished or going to hell or getting rewarded with heaven or anything like that. Because, you know, you learn these things without this program saying, you must finish it by next Tuesday, or else you get a crack across the face. You don't. We're just gently nudged into the direction of doing what is right. And we find that we feel better. We get a little serenity, and that starts to work, and we start to do more and more and more. And pretty soon, we're walking around feeling terrific about ourselves, and we're not expecting any rewards. No, I haven't got that down 100%, but after 20-some years, it's gone a long way. And I feel terrific these days. In making amends, my sponsor pointed out that I had left my parents off the list. And I said, I don't want to. He said, you better. I said, but I was the victim. He said, you still are, and that's your fault. I said, yeah, I guess so. And I realized, of course, that they had changed and become much better parents. My kid brother is 14 years younger than I am. He never got hit. He was brought up with more unconditional love than I was. Mine was conditional. Later on, it became unconditional, but the damage had been done, and I was that, you know, scared kid inside, and obedient, following orders, and all of that stuff, and marching to everybody else's drummer instead of finding my own, playing my own drum. So I had to make for him a list of all the good things my parents had done for me. And there were many, and it went on and on and on. I won't go on about them now, but it was a wonderful list. And I just felt a release. And I decided to, the amends to my mother was, my father had died, was to treat her more nicely over the phone and not to be so short with her. In other words, become a loving son, warm and fuzzy instead of prickly. You know, and that's all in attitude and on phone calls and letters. In fact, I sent her out of the blue, I sent her a little note because she used to tend goats back in Austria when she came home from school. And so I sent, and she used to tell me stories which she made up. I mean, she was wonderful. And I sent her this little clipping from the paper, and it said, pregnant billy goat for sale, $50. And I wrote underneath, I said, if this guy is really pregnant, he's got to be worth more than $50. Well, she loved that. So we had that kind of relationship. So one night, we're on the phone, and we're chit-chatting, having a good time. And out of the, I mentioned my kid brother up in Rhode Island. I said, he's a wonderful guy. You have a wonderful son there. And she said, I have a wonderful son living in California. I said, well, thank you. That's very nice. And she said, why I have that in my life, I have no idea. Because of the terrible way I treated you when you were a little boy and I was such an angry young woman. Wow. And I was able to say to her, you gave me so many gifts that you don't even know them. And I started to go through the list which my sponsor had had me make. And I said, I've forgotten about all that other stuff. That's been forgotten a long time ago. This is what I remember that you gave me, Mom. And I love you. Well, she was in tears. So was I. But she was free. And so was I. My childhood was validated. My perception was validated. But she was free. Only because of this program, because if I had not changed my attitude toward her, she never would have opened up to me because I had become warm. And she'd been carrying that guilt for years and not knowing how to get through to me because I was there and my anger was still showing. Thank you, program. Because of this program with my wife and I both going into our programs, our marriage, all the good things that we had in it and recognized from early days on, now blossom. She went to programs, she sponsored women, I sponsored guys, went to meetings all the time. Our marriage became incredible. We were so relaxed with each other. We never argued, never fought, never raised our voices. It was bliss. She was gardening and raising vegetables and flowers and rescuing pussycats, and I was doing shows, or I wasn't doing that. I was putzing around the building, doing what my father used to do when I was a kid. They were superintendents of the building. And I designed the sprinkler system for the owner, and I used to be an engineer, to go in with the architecture, and all. It was an old building. So I was having fun doing that. I had all kinds of stuff. We traveled. We loved each other. It could have gone on forever, and we knew every day for 27 years, 26 years, every day. What we had, and that love we had, was people just said, what is it with you two? What is it with you? You like each other. You're so good to each other. And we were, and we knew it. And we thank program and the stars and heavens and God and who knows what. And then the diagnosis came, and she had stage 4 cervix cancer. And the first thing, the odds were 6-1 against. And she said, when I die, I want you to go out and have a ball. So one day at a time. We took her to treatment. She went through chemo, radiation. She got chemo brain. She got everything, you know. And she was okay. When she could, she'd garden, take care of pussycats, go to meetings. But she struggled and fought on bravely. I went on. I kept doing what I did. I worked around the building. I did this. I did that. I went to meetings. And it was a tough year. And finally, she got the all clear. We went, yay! Went home free. And we were so happy. And so were our friends, so were everyone else. And then in a matter of weeks, there was something wrong. And she went in for an exam, and I was there. We were there together, and the doctor said, there's an inoperable mass in the stomach, and you have about 6 weeks to live. So I took her home, and we embraced. And she said to me, this is the kind of woman she was. She said, you know how lucky I am? And I'm thinking, what can you be talking about lucky? And she said, I'm almost 81. I've had a most incredible life, a most beautiful marriage. What about all the poor people in the world who have never had a chance at any of that? She said, I'm so grateful. I just weeping. So we took it a day at a time, and I got a day nurse in and to help out, and everything else I did. And I took, and my disease kicked in. I took care of all the 15 hours at night, and she gradually had to go on heavy duty morphine, and she was out of it a lot of the time. And I slept in the living room near the hospital bed that she was in, and she'd wake up several times a night, and I have to lift her out of bed. And we had a portable potty, and we go through all that, and we have accidents, and she's not aware, and it's all very undignified, but I'm glad she wasn't aware. And I kept doing it and kept doing everything during the day, what I should have done. I suddenly stopped going to meetings, stopped calling my sponsor, and I was doing everything. My disease kicked in. I fell off the Al-Anon wagon. I was Superman. I do everything. I did the job of two nurses and the laundry. And, of course, you couldn't eat a lot of cooking art, but I was doing things, you know, and cleaning up the house and all that stuff. And I didn't realize I was getting almost no sleep. I'd be up 5-6 times a night. And each time, it would take a half an hour because, I mean, I have to lift her out of bed. And I would lie there, and I couldn't sleep because if she coughed, I'd be... And I'll put it this way. I found out later in the hospital two things. I'd lost about 25 pounds in 3 weeks. I had no vitamin D in my system and other nutrients. I was dead on my feet, and that if I had been a prisoner of war, I would have confessed to anything or done anything. I shouldn't have been out driving. I shouldn't have been out doing anything. But I was driven, and I was doing it all. And it was crazy. And the one night when, somewhere out of the depths, she was slightly conscious, and I could hear her say, I can't go on like this anymore. I thought, oh my God, is she asking me to give her an OD on morphine or what? And I didn't know what to do. And I put her back into the bed, and I went, I had to get a pill to sleep because I just knew I couldn't sleep. And as I got the thing of pills, you know, the Hamlet thing, to be or not to be, and well, this is noble in the lives of the slings and arms of outrageous fortune. Or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them. And a thousand natural shocks, the flesh is there too. It is a consummation devoutly to be wished, to die, to sleep, or to sleep. And woke up in the hospital 3 or 4 days later. What the hell have I done? Oh my God, and I called. And I left a message that I'd try to get out of the hospital as soon as possible. I hope she was all right. And they said, she's so out of it. She's on so much morphine. She doesn't know anything. I said, okay. A couple of days later, she died. And then the loss set in. And the psychiatrists and everybody there were telling me, they said, you were temporarily insane. You're not a mental case. We're going to throw you out of here. We're going to work with you, but you're going to have to get out on your own because you don't belong here. And they were right. I was terribly, terribly sad and clinically depressed. And what happened? I had lost my program, and the program came back to me. And men and women from this meeting and other meetings started pouring into my room saying, we need you back. We love you. You're part of our group. Come back. We need you. We want you. And they chipped away on me, chipped away, chipped away, chipped away. And suddenly, I finally realized, you know, yeah, that's one of my purposes in life, and that's what it is today, to come back. And I came back, and I was embarrassed. I came to this meeting, and as Jack C. says, you know, this is a program of forgiveness and second chances, and we don't shoot our wounded. Nobody shot me. They helped me back. But I was embarrassed when I got here, and they asked me to read the opening prayer for my first meeting in 3 months. I said my name, and over 90 men stood up and clapped, applauded, cheered, and screamed, we love you. We're glad you're back. We want you. We need you. Worst year of my life, one of the finest moments of my life at the same time. And so I'm back. And as some of the boys have said, now that you've been to hell and back, you're even more important to us because we know that's possible too. Even some of the other men in this room who have lost their wives and they kept their program, they know what I'm talking about. They help me. I help them. I had a guy tell me the other day, he said, you have no idea what you mean to this group. I said, I probably don't, because there's something about this program which I've always believed, that it's an inside job. I used to worry about what people thought of me, my image. I was like corporations. They spend billions on their image, so you think they're nice guys, and then they steal every last cent you've got. Screw the image. If I do the inside job and work on my substance, the image will take care of itself. And when I get nice feedback about that image, I can't take the credit. I give the program credit for that. And this program has remade my life. It's reparented me. It's, you know, the good qualities it has have rubbed off on me. Tolerance, flexibility, lack of rigidity, all embracing, just a general spirit of optimism. All these things become part of me, and it gets better and better. And we're all on the same journey. And this is indeed all about the journey and not the destination. Because we'll never get to the top. I mean, that's impossible. But I've got a higher power. I live a spiritual life. It's not necessarily God. You know, I don't know what's going on out there afterwards. You know, all I know is this, is that if I keep living my life according to the principles of this program, I have nothing to worry about when I die. That's it. End of story. My higher power has always come to the fore and helped me and rescued me. My sponsor's there, the program's there, and I'm so grateful. I love this program. Believe me, it has saved my life, because when I lost the program, I almost lost my life. I'm living proof. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, our experience can be of help and strength to benefit to others. I have no secrets. We're as sick as our secrets. I love the program. I love the men in this room. The men who are not here. And I leave you with my signature sign-off, which came to me years ago, and I mean it. As I do with mine, may you and your higher power walk hand in hand.